But now we're in a place where technology has spread into the physical world. So things like drones, autonomous vehicles, 3D printers, Internet of Things, advanced analytics from, you know, networks of sensors and big data. All of this means that there's just so many more technologies that are having an impact on our economy and on the government as well.
If you're a technology partner looking to optimize your engagement with the tech giants like Microsoft, you're in the right place. Welcome to The Ultimate Guide to Partnering with your host, Vince Menzione.
Welcome to the 31st episode of The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. My guest for this episode of the podcast is Casey Coleman, Senior Vice President of Global Government Solutions at Salesforce. Salesforce has been a pioneer and at the forefront of business transformation, and Casey has been at the intersection of both government and industry, having served as the CIO of GSA during the federal government's push to a cloud-first strategy during the Obama administration. In this episode, we peel back on Casey's role at Salesforce, some of Salesforce's solutions focused in on the government sector, Salesforce as a company, and the amazing Dreamforce event taking place in San Francisco in just a few days. As with each of my episodes, I appreciate your feedback. You can reach me on LinkedIn or at email at vincem@cloudwavepartners.net. And now with the latest version of iOS, it's easier than ever to rate and review this podcast. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Casey, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Vince. I'm glad to be here.
I am excited to have you today to share with our listeners your role at Salesforce, the company's amazing value proposition, what you look for in successful partnerships, your career journey, and your personal story. So welcome.
Thank you.
Casey, I'm fascinated by how people got to this particular spot in life, and you've been the recipient of several awards and honors: Top 50 Women in Technology, FedScoop Excellence in Government, Federal Executive of the Year, really a long list of accomplishments. I would love if you would share with our listeners how you got started, how you eventually wound up in government service, and now in industry. Could you take our listeners through it?
Yeah, you bet. I'll give you the short version. I've had quite a lot of changes in my career. I think the common theme through it all has been I've always enjoyed working at the intersection of technology and business and being on the boundary between those two worlds and trying to be a effective communicator to both audiences, because they don't always speak the same language. I started off with my education in that very same vein. I got an undergraduate degree in computer science and an MBA in finance. So I was trying from the very beginning to span those two worlds. I entered government at a couple of different points. I served on the Hill in the House of Representatives on a committee staff 1 year as a legislative fellow through an engineering fellowship. So I took a leave of absence from work, moved from Dallas to Washington, and was here in D.C. for a year, and then moved back. It was just a one-year assignment. And then after 9/11, I was really motivated to return to Washington. There was you may remember the national sentiment was really one of trying to bring the country together and wanting to do something to recover and move forward and to help in a more significant way. And that really motivated me personally to reconnect with the people I'd worked with in D.C. and find a way to return in this time the executive branch at GSA. And I spent 12 years there, the last 7 years as the CIO for the agency.
And that's when you and I met. In fact, we met at a government conference. I think it was an offshoot of the Computer Electronics Show. There was a government breakout session. And at that time, you were leading the organization through transformation and were one of the first to drive a cloud-first strategy through GSA. And I thought maybe you could spend a few moments there talking about that experience of change at GSA and what hurdles you had to overcome and issues that you faced.
Yes, that project was a really interesting one because the Obama administration came into office with a really forward-leaning technology agenda. And one of their policies that was published pretty early on in the first Obama term was the cloud-first policy. And so it became clear that agencies needed to align to move to cloud solutions. And I was on the CIO Council, one of the CIOs who meet regularly on these kind of policy topics. And so I volunteered to lead the cloud group, the cloud committee. And so through that multi-agency forum, we put together the cloud security policy that became FedRAMP. And we put together sort of how you, you know, what's the roadmap? What's the journey to move to the cloud? We had to figure out for the first time, really, what are the security issues? What are the purchasing and procurement issues and the data management, mobility, and legal issues? There's just a lot of, it's just a different business model that required a new approach. And it so happened that GSA had an opportunity for us to take advantage of that policy and move from a legacy email and collaboration system to a cloud-based approach. And in doing so, we took the whole agency through that journey and learned a lot along the way, and fortunate to have really strong support from the top down. It was a very successful initiative.
Can you peel back on that a little bit? What were the key learnings that you found?
Well, one of them is that I think you should always look at what motivates people and give them a stake in the success of the initiative. The natural inclination, I think, of federal workers is to be conservative. And that comes from, you know, the very important work that they do, life and health and safety issues, and really important national security issues. So there's a natural conservatism that sort of hinders change, both for good and for bad. You don't want them to be veering off in directions that ultimately aren't fruitful. But there's a time for change. And so at GSA, one of the cultural touchstones of GSA is that they are a procurement organization for the rest of the federal government. And so it falls on them to be knowledgeable about new technologies and new business approaches. And so by going through these things first, they learn and understand and can offer perspective to other agencies. So we've really tapped into that cultural and mission-oriented theme for this change. And we tied everything back to, this is our drive to the cloud. We are going to go first. And by doing so, we're going to be able to help our customers in that same journey. So the change management piece of it was really founded upon giving people a stake in the success and making it part of the mission that everyone feels so strongly about.
You know, I saw a lot of organizations struggle at that point, and it seems like the transformation is happening faster and faster now. Are you observing the same thing in government?
Oh, absolutely. There's an enormous amount of change. It's not just the changes in technology. It's also technology spreading into new markets. So we're now in what some are calling the fourth industrial revolution. You think about earlier shifts, industrial revolutions, you know, the first was maybe the introduction of steam power and then mass production and then the internet and, you know, IT technologies. But now we're in a place where technology has spread into the physical world. So things like drones, autonomous vehicles, 3D printers, Internet of Things, advanced analytics from, you know, networks of sensors and big data. All of this means that there's just so many more technologies that are having an impact on our economy and on the government as well. So there's a real challenge to pick and choose the right ones that make sense for agencies to look at and implement to affect their mission. So it's quite a challenge.
Do you still see agencies that struggle with the transformation and adopting these new technologies? And what would you tell them now if you could?
Yeah, I do. I still think there's quite a challenge. If you were to look at a bell curve of adoption, I think we're probably still in the first third of that wave, even for something like cloud computing, which is now probably in its seventh or eighth year of maturing, maybe even longer. What I say to customers and to other agencies and to colleagues in this market is some of the things that were relevant to me as a CIO, I think are still relevant. For one, the tendency is to think of cloud computing as this very different thing. It's really just a different business model. It's not really a different technology model. It's the same technologies you might have on-premise, but you're buying it through a cloud service provider who is always keeping it updated, always keeping it secure. And so you no longer have to budget for and plan for those 3 to 5 year upgrades that are so stressful to the organization. So it takes complexity out of the equation. And I really think complexity is an underappreciated environment in government technology worlds, because the more complexity you have, the more difficulty you have securing it, managing it, and implementing it, and delivering for your stakeholders.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I found that on the government side, they were always more latent to transform to the next revision of the technology, right? So we saw that quite a bit.
Further behind, building up technical debt. And then you reach a point where it's almost impossible to get to the new version because you've got two or three or more revisions to go through to get there. It becomes kind of impossible.
So now you lead government solutions globally for Salesforce. Yeah. Would you mind sharing for our listeners a little bit about your role and the mission of your organization?
Yeah, I joined Salesforce earlier this year, and we implemented Salesforce. I was previously a customer when I was in the government, so I was familiar with the company and with their culture, what they do. I really love Salesforce because not just do we have great products, but we have great people and a great culture. It's a very open place where you can have an impact very quickly. You don't have to be here for a long time, you know, work your way up through the ranks. And they really make a point of listening to and paying not just lip service, but actual diligence to all the voices here. Equality is one of our core values. So at Salesforce, I lead our global government industry team. We in the company have organized around seven different industry verticals to really be able to better understand our customers in those markets. Government is one of them. And so my responsibility is to connect our account teams and our customers globally, make sure that we really understand the government market, how they buy, what solutions are relevant to them, what are the constraints and the compliance and legal frameworks that they have to operate within, and making sure that we are relevant to them in their markets and the missions that they're serving.
So are you a go-between between the product group or the engineering side of the business and the sales business? Is that how you see your role?
Yeah, we really are a go-between. That's exactly right. But also out to customers, out to partners, system integrators and independent software vendors, making sure that they're part of this ecosystem and being able to operate effectively. So we really are sort of the web, the fabric that connects all of the different pieces of the ecosystem in the government market.
So you touched on this a little bit, but you know, I wonder if peel back on Salesforce as a company, because A, the first major player in the SaaS space, right? I mean, the first true cloud computing company back in, I think it was 99 and early 2000s.
Yeah.
Can you share with our listeners what it's like to work for Salesforce and how it is fundamentally different than other organizations you've worked with or for?
Yeah, I would just maybe start with the fact that Salesforce was founded from, as you said, from the very beginning in the cloud, which was different from anyone else. And so we don't have a legacy business of on-premise solutions that our customers are trying to manage as they're moving to the cloud. So we are all in on cloud from the beginning. We're also founded and continue to be a company organized around very explicit culture and core values. And I mentioned equality. We have four core values: growth, innovation, equality, and trust. And trust is our number one value. And we just make that really explicit because our customers trust us. And that trust is a really important element of our support for them. So, you know, there's this saying that culture trumps strategy. And that, you know, the meaning of that is that whatever the culture, be it intentional or not, is going to end up having way more influence in a company than the strategy, because the culture is the, you know, the environment we all live in. So I really love that about Salesforce, that they've been very intentional about building a culture that is puts the customers and the customer success at the center of all we do. We're also a company that really is very philanthropic and really committed to giving back. We pioneered a model that we call 1-1-1. We give 1% of our equity, 1% of our product, and 1% of our employees' time through paid time off to volunteer causes. And so we have a foundation that enables this 1-1-1 model and do a ton of great work in the communities that we are a part of around the world.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit more about customer obsession, customer opportunity. How do you and Salesforce think differently about the government market and the customer opportunity and partner community in government?
Well, as I said earlier, we were very explicit about the fact that our customers and their success comes first. And you probably would never find a company that disagreed with that statement, but I don't think you'd find the same level of intentional focus and really, you know, carrying through, not just with the statement of support, but organizing everything we do around that. So I felt that as a customer. I really felt that Salesforce was a partner and not just a vendor, in the sense that I felt like, you know, they're always going to have our best interests in view. You see that, I think, with this cloud model. It's no longer do you have to go through these upgrades and have to manage the environment yourself. It really takes a lot of that burden off the CIOs. They have sort of a future-proof solution, and they can focus not on the nuts and bolts of maintaining the system, but on really delivering the applications and the value and the innovation that even governments are looking for. You know, government organizations have to move at a pace that, you know, would have been unfamiliar in previous years. And we help them do that.
So can you talk about some key customer opportunities or key customers that you have, and why did they choose Salesforce over other vendors?
Sure. You know, as I said earlier, my scope is international. So let me start with a couple of international customers. In Australia, the state of New South Wales, which is the state where Sydney is located, has standardized on Salesforce for all of their transportation. So there's a lot of water around Sydney and the, of course, the province there. And so everyone has a boat, a water taxi, and ferries is a very common way to get around. There's also rail and bus, and then there's, of course, roads and commuters. So there's a variety of transport modes, and New South Wales has organized all of these different modalities of transportation in Salesforce so that you can plan your journey. You can see where, you know, trains may be running late or ferries have, you know, been interrupted by whatever else may be going on, so you can plan your route, you can see what's going on in the broader environment, and you can connect different modes of travel into a single journey. And you can buy your passes online, you can maintain your account, you can get proactive notices, and then the state can see what's going on in terms of the transportation, where they need to focus resources. So that's been a real success story.
You know, that reminds me of some of the conversations I've been having with organizations around smart cities initiatives. And this is an application that fits right in there. I've even heard of other, and maybe this is the case in New South Wales, that agencies you could actually time things like an Uber driver, you know, connecting at a station or when your ferry gets on the other side. Is that the case here?
I do know you can arrange for a pickup, and this is more the case for people who are mobility limited and need specific bus or, you know, door side pickup. You can organize that through this application. There's certainly no limitation to the different channels you could incorporate. So that's all within not just the art of the possible, but the easily doable.
How about in the United States government? Any examples you have there?
Yeah, there's you mentioned connected cities in smart cities. Denver, but the city and county of Denver has standardized on Salesforce for 311 services. And you know, 311 is non-emergency services. So it's things like information like library hours and where is my polling place for voting. It also includes things like reporting the need for city services like potholes or streetlights that are out, or you can, you know, graffiti or abandoned buildings. So anything the city does, you can report and track through the mobile application and social media channels that are supported by Salesforce. And then the city can dispatch the services, they can track where the resources are going, and they can start to get in front of it. So they can see where, you know, there may be a certain hot spot, and they can drill down on that, find out what's happening there, and start to apply resources proactively. There's a number of other cities who have that same approach. So that's been a very, you know, there's a lot of success in that area. And then on the federal level, the U.S. Department of Agriculture uses Salesforce for managing loans to farmers and ranchers. So there's over 2,200 field service offices in the Farm Service Agency at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And they are now able to have the same information. They can communicate with producers, farmers, and ranchers through mobile devices. So they don't have to come into the office, bring their paperwork, stand in line, wait their turn. They can do it, you know, while they're sitting on the tractor or out in the field working, because you know, the work doesn't stop just so you can go into the office and wait for government to, you know, help you with your situation.
Nice. And why do you believe that these organizations chose Salesforce over other vendors?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. I think that customers choose Salesforce, or what I hear from them is that, first of all, it's about Salesforce as a partner. So there's the issues I mentioned earlier about trust and about customers first. There's also our platform, which is the world's number one CRM. It is the top player in this market. And so going with number one is always a good strategy. We've always been innovating. We received the Innovator of the Decade Award from Forbes magazine. So we're known as the company and the partner that's going to be out in front and to deliver new capabilities even before our customers realize there's a use for them. They also appreciate the fact that it's really easy to use. It's really easy to develop in and to add and extend the platform. One of the big philosophies and priorities at Salesforce is to really democratize innovation. We don't believe that it's, you know, technology should be the province of just, you know, the few who are able to master the narrow skill sets, but to really make it very easy to become a Salesforce administrator and developer. In fact, we put all of our training online for free at trailhead.salesforce.com so that people can go there and get certified and participate in the STEM economy through the forums we provide.
And what do you believe are the greatest opportunities for continued growth in government? Where do you see the curve going?
Well, there's still so much growth left in the CRM market. It is across the board, across all industries, CRM is the fastest enterprise market in terms of growth. So there's still enormous uptake yet to come in our core market. But I would point to artificial intelligence and the Internet of Things as two exceptionally fast-growing areas for us. Internet of Things is really, as you know, it's really applying sensors and technology in the physical environment to manage it. And our particular approach to the Internet of Things is to be the management platform for IoT. So we're not providing the sensors or the network. We're providing the management platform to track and make use of that data. And then pair that with the Internet of Things, with advanced analytics capabilities called Einstein. So bringing Einstein into the equation to make sense of the data and bring in other data sources, both internal and external, to not only understand what's going on, but be able to infer and be able to predict and be able to make decisions about, you know, the way that you need to manage it going forward.
So with the Internet of Things, the sensors out in the environment collecting the data, maybe we're talking about those ferries or trains that are running in Australia.
Yeah.
And then the collection comes in through Salesforce, and then Einstein maybe takes a look at the ferry schedule and says, maybe we need to change that accordingly to support maybe a influx of people or a capacity issue.
Yes, that's a good example.
So we're recording this in the weeks leading up to the amazing Dreamforce conference in San Francisco. We already talked about the culture of Salesforce, but I've heard many great things about the Dreamforce event, that it's really an amazing happening. I hear 100,000 people congregating in San Francisco for a week or more. And this is the week of November 6th that it's taking place. Can you tell our listeners a bit about how you're thinking about your first Dreamforce event and your role at the event?
Yeah, I am really looking forward to Dreamforce. You're right. It is the world's largest software conference. It is 100,000 plus. And so it is not just a conference, but an event, a happening. And it's really all about helping our customers innovate and helping them to make better use of our platform and be able to, not just from a technology perspective, but also a strategy perspective. So there's a lot of very senior leaders, CXOs, who are gathering there, a lot of very senior government officials. One of the highlights that I'll have an opportunity to participate in is a keynote session where I'm bringing some customers onto the stage to talk about the government market and how we really crack open the innovation capabilities and help them to create the government of the future. So it's all about the opportunity, as I said a minute ago, get out of line and get online and be able to serve your customers in a way that suits their needs where they are.
And so for our listeners who are coming to the event, I'll be asking you for a link to the schedule for the event, if that's okay with you, so we can make sure that our government listeners and government partners that are attending will attend that session.
You bet.
So I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk about partners, since this is the Ultimate Guide to Partnering and we focus on that specific area of technology. You have quite a bit of experience working with vendors and in your most recent role with partners as well. What do you believe makes, or what characteristics do you believe makes a great partner?
Well, a great partner is from a, you know, just a general point of view is, I think there's got to be some empathy involved and the ability to understand holistically the interests and the needs of all the different participants, because there's the relationship between Salesforce and the vendors, and then between Salesforce and the customers, the government users and the partners, you know, and then there's the ultimate customer, the citizen, the member of the public who's benefiting from government services or using government services. So being able to understand the second and third order degree of impact and being able to plan and move quickly and do so in a way that's very thoughtful about the ultimate mission that we're trying to fulfill, I think that's an important first characteristic.
Have you seen situations where partners have failed working with your organization? And this isn't just with Salesforce, but just in general in your years of experience in technology in the industry.
Yeah, I haven't seen that at Salesforce. I've certainly observed, and we've all read about situations where in the IT community, you know, the government IT community, there have been challenges. And I think if you look at the root cause for those kind of situations, it often goes to a divergence of interests where, you know, the government had a mission and the supporting partner had a different perspective and they weren't aligned. You can go back and look at it more root cause. I don't think there's ever one party to blame. I certainly have seen situations when I was in the government where I felt like we could have done a better job communicating what we needed. Not because we didn't communicate, but, you know, we were learning as we were going. And I think that points to the challenges of where technology has been and a reason for optimism about where we're going. Because if you think about, I'll call them the bad old days, it used to take years and millions of dollars to deploy a new initiative. And so it's no wonder we didn't get it right all the time, because things change in that time. And you can't have perfect foreknowledge about what's needed. But now with modern technologies, including cloud and mobile and agile scaled agile type of development approaches and DevOps, you can move very quickly. You can iterate fast. You can change things that can, you know, be quickly fielded. And so you don't have to wait years and put in tens of millions of dollars before you can see a change. We also have the ability now to separate out back office systems and front office or front-facing systems of engagement, so that we can rapidly change the user interface and the customer experience, and we can be a lot more careful and thoughtful and deliberate about changes to things like master data records and business processes. So, you know, I've kind of wandered away from your original question, but I think partners generally always try to do the right thing by their customers. I've seen that fundamental good intent in every case, but communication and the ability of technology to move quickly and then to jointly make the right decisions for the outcomes is something I think is a far better state today.
Yeah, you raised some really good points, and it really points to the transformation and how the cloud has enabled that. It's the rapid development, the agile IT, and how it's a much different environment than years ago when it took 5 years and $100 million. And when you got it completed, it didn't meet the requirements any longer, right?
You really don't hear about situations like that very often anymore.
No, we heard about it many times in the past, though.
Yeah.
So talk to me about partners wishing to work with you and your organization. Is there any advice you have or ways that they should reach out to you and the team?
Yeah, there's we love our partners and are always interested to talk to partners and prospective partners about working together. I think it's always helpful to bring something to that conversation so that it's not just about, hey, we want to work with you, but you know, hey, we have relationships here, or we have a particular point of view that we think complements what Salesforce is doing, so that there is a, you know, sort of a marriage of equals in terms of the contributions and the point of view and the thought leadership of all the participants.
So I'd like to come back to your personal and professional story for a little bit here and spend a little time here, because there's a great opportunity, I believe, with this podcast to share for early and career professionals. And so I'd like to ask you a couple questions there. The first of which is there any great advice you got when you first got started that you keep with you and kind of continue with?
Absolutely. The one thing that has really stuck with me from the very earliest days of my professional career is take a chance. And I heard this from my dad. I also heard this from my first manager, who encouraged me to take that engineering fellowship and move to Washington for that opportunity on Capitol Hill. And the nugget there is that you won't know what could happen unless you try. And so you should make smart choices, but we can't make perfect choices. So if you take a chance, if you try something new, if you make a move and it doesn't work out, you'll at least learn something. And you will meet new people, and you'll position yourself in a way that will be helpful going forward. So I think there's not much downside and a lot of potential upside to just taking a chance and trying something a little outside your comfort zone.
Did you take a chance at any point and have a hurdle that was difficult to overcome?
Yes, many times. For example, that move to DC, I didn't know anyone. I remember it was, you know, had to, a new city that had to make connections and figure out how to, you know, function here. And even more recently, leaving the government and moving back into industry was a challenge. It was, again, a little outside my comfort zone, because I had reached a place where I felt like I sort of understood what was expected of me and how to deliver effectively in the previous role. And so I wanted to continue challenging myself, continue learning. And so I took a new role that was in industry. So I've done that many times, and I always feel like if I'm well within my comfort zone, then it's time to do something different and shake that up.
You've been a role model to others and women in technology and just across government and industry, but was there any one role model that you had, either directly or indirectly, that you looked to, and what advice or what attributes did you learn from them?
You know, I've had a lot of mentors, and probably not necessarily famous people, but people who took an interest in me and gave me candid and helpful feedback. I mentioned my dad. I mentioned my first manager. A lot of people when I was at GSA gave me a lot of wisdom. I remember hearing from one that you should always be careful of everything you say, because someone's going to take it out of context and put it in print, and then you'll not be able to correct yourself. And so that caused me to be very thoughtful and careful about what I said, you know, in a way that, you know, when I wasn't on similar kind of stage, I might not have been quite so careful. So I've had a lot of mentors, and I always think when people ask me about mentoring, you know, no one is ever insulted to be asked to be a mentor. People are always happy to see developing employees and more junior professionals take an interest in, you know, doing better and being more effective and learning from those around them. So I don't think you should ever hesitate to ask for perspectives or even mentoring advice from others. But you should also be the kind of person who is known for their reputation for doing good work, so that people are happy to be associated with and help you in that journey.
So what advice would you give to your 25-year-old self?
I think I would say, don't be so critical to myself. I probably, like a lot of people, was always, you know, re-examining and sort of self-criticizing, trying to figure out what I could do better. And, you know, things have worked out as they have, and it's all been fine. So probably could have chilled a little bit.
Was that at a time after you got your master's degree or while you were in the process?
Probably throughout. I was working when I was going to grad school. And so I was, you know, staying up late, doing class and work and trying to fit it all in. So that was kind of a stressful period, but ultimately it was well worth it.
So what pursuits or obsessions does Casey enjoy when she's not working or explore when you're not working?
Well, I love anything outdoors. I love biking. I love running. I've recently gotten into doing CrossFit, which I think is really fun because there's sort of a really enthusiastic community that participates in the CrossFit classes. And so you feel like you're part of a little crowd of people who share your interest in being fit and healthy and trying to get stronger and be able to then take that energy that it gives you from working out and do a good job at work. So I really love that. My husband and I both love dogs. And so we have four dogs, which is a little crazy. We do a lot of dog rescue and dog training and especially German Shepherds. So we spend a lot of time in doing dog things.
Nice. I was going to ask you big dogs or small dogs, but you answered that for me.
Well, since we have four, we have two of each.
Is that right? What are the other dogs?
The two German Shepherds, and then we have two that are rescues, and they're both terrier mixes. And believe me, the littles are a lot more high maintenance than the bigs.
I have a little dog. I can agree with that one. So is there a quote you live your life by or you think of often?
Yeah, it's funny. I was just thinking about this today. I was talking with some members of my team. One of my favorite quotes is from Teddy Roosevelt. And there's a couple of different variations of it, but the gist of it is, it's the man in the ring. It's the fighter in the ring who's making the difference. It's not the people standing around on the outside cheering or booing. You know, there's always going to be second guessers who are standing on the sidelines, but it's the person who rolls up their sleeves and gets in the ring and takes on the challenges who really is to be admired. And so, you know, others will, you know, wish that they had committed themselves to something like that when they see the effort and the success that comes from that kind of commitment.
That's a favorite quote of mine as well. And he was talking to the critics of, I believe at the time, the people that were criticizing his work in government.
Well, there's a lot of that.
So if you had a personal billboard, and this is a metaphor for a message you'd like to send out to the world, what would you share on it?
Well, I'd certainly go back to the statement, take a chance. And then the other thing that I'm always reminding myself of is assume good intent. You know, it's so easy, especially in the world we live in today where things move so quickly. Social media makes it possible to communicate instantly to a lot of people we don't know. Easy to assume that, you know, the people we disagree with have some ill intent. But I've always found when I've sat down and talked with people I disagreed with that we all had a lot in common, a lot more in common than things we disagreed about. And so, and you know, people are coming to their point of view from some reasoned perspective. So you might not ultimately agree, but if you assume good intent, then you can start off a conversation with a lot more possibility of finding a way forward together than if you start off assuming that they're, you know, there's ill intent.
I agree. Assume good intent. I like that quite a bit, actually. Yep. Yeah. That's a great one. And it's a timely for this time in our, yeah, in our world. Is there one book that you have read or bestowed often that you would recommend to our listeners?
You know, there's a bunch of good ones. I like Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In. I think it's not just for women, but it's about, you know, really professionals and people who are trying to make a difference in their career and stepping up and being heard and not waiting for someone to point you out and call on you, but being proactive and, you know, managing your own career and trying to be part of the solution, trying to be part of the good that's happening. So that's one I like a lot.
And where do you want to be in 3 to 5 years, or where do you see yourself being in 3 to 5 years, Casey?
Well, I haven't been good at predicting that so far. So there's a low probability I'll be able to predict that accurately today. But I, early in my journey here at Salesforce, I hope that I continue to contribute and make a difference here and be able to expand my capabilities with the customers and the partners and all the folks I'm working with here. I just think there's so much good happening here. I'm enjoying it professionally.
And for our listeners who'd like to reach out to you, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, you can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Twitter. It's at Casey Coleman. I was lucky enough to get that for my Twitter handle. So I'm pretty easy to reach. I check both of those pretty regularly.
Great. And Casey, I want to thank you so much for joining the Ultimate Guide to Partnering today. It's been a great honor to have you, and I appreciate your time given your compressed schedule. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Vince. It was my pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Ultimate Guide to Partnering with your host, Vince Minzione, online at ultimateguidetopartnering.com and facebook.com/ultimateguidetopartnering. We'll catch you next time on The Ultimate Guide to Partnering.